Let's read again in Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. I want to look at verses 1 through 7. And with a special focus on verse 4. So let's read verse 4 together. For he, that is the ruler, is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that does evil. I want to speak to you today about your other minister. I don't mean Pastor Ian McLeod. And I don't mean Pastor Jenny Bilkis. I mean President Barack Obama. Your other minister. In fact, you have a number of other ministers, as you'll see today. Barack Obama is simply, as it were, at the top of the tree of the other ministers in our lives. Because as we'll see, there are ministers not just for our church, but also for our state. And it's interesting the context for these words being written. Paul was writing here to the Romans, and there was a particular problem in Rome, because the Jews in Rome resented any Gentile ruler over them, and therefore they were very tempted to rebel, and did rebel against the Roman rulers, both in Rome and also in Jerusalem. And of course this was affecting the Christian believers who were coming out of Judaism, who were becoming Christians. They were coming along and bringing along some of these old attitudes towards civil government. So bad was the situation in Rome with the Jews that they were actually eventually exiled by one of the Roman emperors. And so bad was the situation in Jerusalem that, of course, eventually the Romans came and captured Jerusalem after a long siege in 70 AD, resulting in the destruction of Jerusalem. So, Paul here has a very specific issue in mind. He's writing to instruct the young believers about their attitude towards civil government. And he's also writing to protect the church against the perception that the gospel was against government and that the gospel produced rebels. And throughout this passage, he's at pains to demonstrate that if anything, Christians should be noted for their civil obedience rather than their civil disobedience. So I want to look at the three main purposes or roles or descriptions of government that we find in this passage. First of all, we want to know that government is appointed by God. Secondly, that it serves God. And thirdly, that it's answerable to God. First of all, though, government is appointed by God. And as we're thinking about government today, remember that there are other realms of authority in our lives that many of these principles are applicable to, in our church, in our families, in our schools. But today we want our focus to be primarily our rulers in government. And it's interesting, what was the first government? When did the first government arise? There really was no need for government in the beginning. In the unfallen, perfect world, there was no government because God was the governor. There was nobody in between him and the governed. He gave law. He administered law directly, not through anyone else. It was only when sin entered the world and the lawlessness that came with sin, the government then became necessary. And we see it probably initially in its early stages, especially being set up in the post-flood era. God having really demonstrated to everyone what lawlessness leads to, that resulted in his judgment in the flood afterwards, he then begins to set up government, especially with these words, whosoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. Here, God is now putting a layer of human government between himself and his creatures. But I think we can even go a little bit further back and begin to see the germs of civil government being sown even in the initial seconds after the fall. You think of the angel that God put outside the garden with the flaming sword to prevent Adam and Eve coming back into the garden and eating of the tree of life. That was God's first law enforcement officer, you might say, bearing his sword, ruling in his name to punish any who would cross his path. So, government really is directly tied into the eruption of sin in the world. But it's not just the first government that God established, whether it was in the garden or after the flood. This passage tells us that God establishes every government. It's stated both positively and negatively. If you look at verse 1, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers. Why? For there is no power but of God, but from God. And then it's stated positively. The powers that be are ordained of God. Notice what it's saying. It's saying, you find any government in the world, you can say this. It's not there apart from that it came from God. And you can put it positively. Any power that there is there because God has appointed it. God has established it. And it's fascinating because there's no qualification here. It's not most governments or good governments or small governments or capitalist governments or Republican governments. It's all government. Good or bad, big or small, capitalist or communist, Democrat or Republican, evil or benign. These verses are true. There is no government but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. As the Lord said in Proverbs 8, by me kings reign. As Jesus himself said to Pilate when he's standing in front of him, you could have no power at all, but that it was given to you of God. And they rule not just by permission. Not just by divine permission, but divine appointment. The word used here is ordination. Now, that doesn't mean, as we'll see, God approves of every government or of every government action. But it definitely means he has appointed, he has established, he has ordained every single government that we see anywhere in the world. It's hard to accept that, isn't it? That's what the Bible says. And we have to believe it. What does this actually mean, though, for our daily lives? Well, first thing is, we've got to thank God for government. It's a mercy. Government is a mercy of God. You want to see society without government, you look really pre-flood, where government was very, very limited there. All we're told about really was about that angel. And what did it lead to? You see the immorality, you see the murder, you see the lawlessness and the mayhem. It was a mercy that God instituted capital punishment after the flood. If you want to see what no government looks like, why don't you, as I'm sure you're doing, look at Syria today. Look at Iraq today. That's what it looks like without the mercy of government appointed by God. It should be viewed positively. Look at what it says here. Verse 4, he is the minister of God to thee for good. For good. This is a good gift of God. Therefore, we are to thank him for government in general and for government in particular. It's easy, we might say, oh yeah, we thank God for government, and then we turn to the White House and say, well, I'm not thanking God for that. But, again, for all the faults and failings of whatever government rules in America just now, it would be a million times worse without it. We live really in relatively rare days and in a relatively rare place. When you look at the government God has given us compared to what is elsewhere in the world and compared to what we can see throughout human history. Therefore, however hard it may be, there must be an element of thanksgiving in response to these truths, even in our own lives. But also it means we submit to God. We submit to it. And that's how this whole passage begins. Let every soul, not, well, you know, the vast majority, that's for me, I'm going to be the rebel. No, it says let every soul. It's so unconditional and unqualified, isn't it? Let every soul be subject to the higher powers. Here he's saying, whatever else the believer is to be characterized by in his relationship, her relationship to the government, is this: submission, acceptance of it as God's appointment. That doesn't mean we don't vote it out when we have opportunity. It doesn't mean, as we'll see, we don't offer critique and we don't try and correct, not at all. But whatever else has to be manifested in our lives, it's this: submission, acceptance, not rebellion, not revolution, unless, as we'll see, in extreme circumstances. So we thank God, we submit to God, and thirdly, we obey God. Again, what this passage is teaching and what the Lord's Day made clear as well is that we are not ultimately just obeying our local or national government, we're ultimately obeying God. He is the ultimate authority. And here we're given a number of reasons why we should be characterized by obedience to our rulers. First of all, we're told here that if we don't, they'll punish us. They'll punish us. Verse 2. Whosoever resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God. You see what he's saying? They're saying your disobedience is not just to him or her or them, but it's to God. Look at verse 3. Wilt thou then not be afraid of that power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. Speaking generally, there are exceptions to this. If thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that does evil. Here's another reason. If you don't obey, you will be punished by the ruler. And then another reason is given, verse 5, wherefore you must needs be subject, not only for wrath, not only because you'll suffer their punishment, but for conscience sake. He's saying it's not just about what they will do, it's about what God will do. It's about your relationship with God for conscience sake. So obey because of bad consequences, and obey because of a bad conscience if you don't. Government is appointed by God. Therefore, thank Him. Therefore, submit. And therefore, obey. Second principle that comes out of this passage is this: government is the servant of God. Not only appointed by God, but a servant of God. He's called here the minister of God, verse 4. So there are basically two kinds of minister in the world. There's ministers in the church, and there are ministers in the state. Both of them servants of God. Notice that. He's the minister of, he's not the servant of the people. And he's not the servant of his party. And he's not the servant of the majority. He, she, they are the servants of God. They're his representatives. They're not the representative for a district so much as a representative of heaven. They're not representatives of a state or a nation. They are representatives of God. Right. Doesn't matter who you want to think about, whether it's Justin Amash or Debbie Stabenow or Gary Peters or Rick Snyder or Barack Obama. Doesn't matter what's in front of their names in the newspapers, whether it's representative or senator or government, governor or president. The Bible tells us here that in front of their names is this: servant of God. Whether they acknowledge or know it or not, they are the ministers of God to rule, therefore, in accordance with His will and for His glory, which will ultimately, as said here, be for the good of society as well. And three duties of the government are brought before us here. It's very limited, really, in its definition of ruling power. First of all, they are to punish evildoers. We're told that, for example, in verse 4, if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he bears not the sword in vain. He is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that does evil. And the wrath they're executing is not their own, it's God's. It's interesting, if you look at the wider context of Romans 13, the end of verse of chapter 12, it says in verse 9, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, rather give place to wrath, for it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Your enemy hunger, feed him, thirst, give him drink. In so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire on his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. What's he saying? He's saying, in all personal matters, it's not up to you to take vengeance. It's up to you to give that over to God, and then God executes, usually through rulers. So it's not saying, you know, okay, you've suffered evil, just suffer it, give up. No, he's saying there's things to do. Give it over and look to the government to execute wrath. This is a call to use the civil government, the civil system, in redressing of civil wrongs. So he is a punisher of evildoers. We are not to take private vengeance, but give it over to the Lord who gives it over, who delegates it to these rulers. Punishment of evildoers. Secondly, the praise of those who do well. And really included in this is protection. says at the end of verse 3, "Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do what is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same." The sword is given not just, of course, to punish the evildoers. In doing that, it protects those who are good doers. And here we're told they're not just to protect the good doers, but to praise and honour, to make clear in a very public way who are the good and who are the evil. Of course, different countries have found different ways of doing this, whether it be medals or an honour system or something like that, funding perhaps. We're going to come back to this because it raises this huge question, doesn't it? Who decides what's good? And who decides what's evil? If they're to punish evil and praise and protect the good, who decides? We're going to come back to that. But then thirdly, they're not just to punish evildoers, praise and protect the good, they are to raise taxes. Verse 6, "For this cause, pay tribute also, pay tax, for they are God's ministers." Third time it says that in the passage. It's quite amazing, isn't it? It's maybe, you know, I think probably, you know, the American culture is so, like, the strength of it is the independence of the people, the self-starting, the entrepreneurial spirit, the self-reliance. It's what's made America so great. And yet, in this area, it's probably why it's a particular weakness. If you're trying to balance this tremendous independence and self-starting and self-reliance, and on the other hand, this submission and obedience and respect and taxes, it causes a tension in us, and that tension will probably be with us all our days as well, and we'll need continual adjustment in our attitudes, in our words, and in our actions. But God here makes very clear that we have to pay tax, and it underlines that again in verse 7, "Render therefore to all their dues, tribute to whom tribute, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honour to whom honour." It's again interesting that God really picks out two groups of people in the whole world for whom people are to pay. People are to gather money to pay. Two groups. One group are the ministers of God in the church, and the other are the ministers of God in the state. And they are to be paid sufficient to allow them to focus on this duty alone. Because notice in verse 6 it says, "They are God's ministers attending continually upon this very thing." It's really for seeing here men and women who are full time at this. It's their continual work, and therefore they need to be paid so that they can focus full time on this responsibility. And it also surely calls upon us to pray for how our taxes are raised and spent. Just as we put our money in the collections, we offer the money to God for the church and his servants and his service, and surely we're praying, "Lord, help the deacons, those with responsibility for this, to use this money well, to put it to the best use possible, to do the greatest good to the greatest number." But likewise, when April 15 comes along, we should be doing the same. As that money is sent, whatever pain it might cause us, there must be prayer that goes along with it. But again, these monies would be well spent, well directed, efficiently used, that corruption would be avoided, and so on. So, they're God's ministers. They have these three duties: punishing evildoers, protecting and providing and praising for the good, raising taxes. What does that mean for us? Well, it means, first of all, we cooperate with them. even to the extent of fighting with them and for them, as they see the need for the sword, as it were, to be wielded by more people. They have the right to call for volunteers to cooperate with them in law enforcement at home and abroad. We cooperate with them. We fight with them, for them. Also, secondly, we pay them. We give our taxes sufficient to relieve them from their jobs. And thirdly, we respect them. Again, it comes back to this. This is a servant of God. He's been appointed by God. He is here called a servant of God. It doesn't call us to like them, but it calls us to honour them in our submission, in our subjection. And it doesn't mean, of course, as we'll see shortly, that it's uncritical honour and acceptance and submission. But it does mean that where we can, we should speak well of them. Wherever good is done, wherever harm is avoided, you know, for all the problems in our government, in our court system, in our police forces, in our armed forces, there's a ton of stuff that's going well. No, you don't read about it in the media. That doesn't sell papers. That doesn't get eyes on screens. But it's incumbent upon Christians to do all that we can to find the good and see the good and praise the good and appreciate the good and welcome the good and encourage the good. Whether it be our law enforcement officers, our military personnel, our local, national government, whatever it may be, as we have opportunity, that they don't just hear from us when we get criticisms and condemnation. They don't just hear from us when we see problems, but that they hear from us when we see good. That's a principle that should apply in every relationship, isn't it? In our relationship to our parents, in our relationship to our ministers and elders, in our relationship to our teachers, and so on. It's basic humanity, isn't it? It's common sense. Hardly needs the Bible to tell us this. And yet we do need the Bible to tell us this. We respect the office, at least. We respect the good that is done in that office, and there's always something. We respect where we can. We give honour and praise where we can. And then lastly, government is answerable to God, as appointed by God, and as the servant of God. They will ultimately be answerable to God. And the higher the responsibility, as James 3 makes clear, the higher the accountability, the greater the responsibility to use this power well. And again, we need to remind all those in authority over us that they too will be judged for how they have used or abused this power. It's not just a blank check. If you abuse this power, you will be judged. Maybe in this world by being removed from office, ultimately. But definitely in the world to come. That's why James says, hey, don't rush into leadership. Be not many masters, for you shall receive the greater condemnation. Yes, there are consequences for the ruled in their failures, but there are also consequences for the rulers. And that's why here, we are to pray for our rulers. It is a solemn responsibility to be a parent, to be a teacher, to be a pastor, to be a state or a national representative, to be a president. It's awesome how much they need our prayers. But they also need our information. How are they to know what is good and what is evil so that they're to punish the one and praise and protect the other? It's an act of love for their souls and their eternal welfare for us to make clear where they are veering away from what is wrong, what is right, and veering towards what is wrong because of the awesome judgment that lies ahead. Not just for the consequences of their evil actions and policies in this world. This whole idea of separation of church and state is not biblical. Yes, sure, the church is not to run the state and the state is not to run the church, but it doesn't mean like separation, like no communication. No. If you look through the whole Bible, whether Old or New Testament, you find prophets, you find apostles speaking truth to power. They're not trying to take over power, but they're trying to guide and direct power to what is good and away from what is evil. No government has absolute right to absolute obedience. They do not have the right to command us to do what is evil or forbid us to do what is good. Like Daniel in the Old Testament, like the apostles in the New, we say to them, we will obey God rather than men when these two things conflict. And it's in love to people's souls that we tell them that. We do not believe in separation of God and state. We believe that God has a right to speak to the state through his appointed representatives in the church. We are to pray for them. That's made so clear in 1 Timothy. I just see the time is gone. You can look it up in 1 Timothy chapter 2. You read the first few verses. We're to pray for their conversion. We're to pray for their ruling, that it will create good conditions for the church to flourish in and people to live lives unmolested by government interference. So, what can we say in conclusion? Well, number one, we can say this: God cares for government. He has a passionate concern for government. He is passionately interested in law and order. And it's not just Paul, it's Peter, it's the prophets, it's through the whole Bible, this divine concern for law and order on earth, for ruling, for governing in a godly and in a good way. Secondly, the stakes are enormous, both for them and for us. Let's just think of us. In our relationship to our rulers, here he makes very clear, we may provoke the wrath of God against us by our words, by our attitudes, by our actions. Who knows how many of us are under that wrath in one way or another? Our lives may be suffering from chastisement and divine affliction because we are disobeying this. The stakes are enormous. In fact, so high. Here in verse 2, we're told that really you can tell a person's spiritual condition and spiritual destiny by their relationship to their rulers. Look at it, the end of verse 2. Whoever resists the power resists the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. Our general attitude, this is again a constant scriptural principle, our general attitude to authority tells us, gives us a great insight into our spiritual condition, our spiritual health, and ultimately our spiritual destiny. That is how high the stakes are. This is not optional. This is not something for everyone else but me. Here is a very clear standard by which I can measure my spiritual condition and my ultimate spiritual destiny. Use this as a beacon, maybe, to warn you about your spiritual needs and to point you to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who alone can subdue rebellious hearts and bring them into submission. Bring them into this respectful obedience. Bring them into a right relationship, whether it be government, whether it be pastors and elders, whether it be our teachers or our parents. Look at where your heart is or not. And if it's in the wrong place, you know the place to go. Because only the King of Kings and Lord of Lords can bring that rebellion under control and replace it with submission. And if the consequences are so great for disobedience to earthly authority, how much more to heavenly authority? God's direct commands. So let us use this as a spur. As a spur. In summary, we can say government is appointed by God. It's the servant of God. And it's answerable to God. Therefore, we are to thank God for our rulers. We are to submit to our rulers. We are to obey our rulers. We are to fight for our rulers. We are to respect our rulers. We are to pay our rulers. We are to inform and warn our rulers. But whatever else this passage teaches us, it's this, that Christians, more than anyone else in all the world, are to be the best citizens they can possibly be in their time and generation. Amen. Let's pray.